Welcome to The Point. I'm Indy Todd. Today it's bird news with Mark Faraday, science coordinator at Mass Audubon's Wellfleet Bay Wildlife Sanctuary. Morning, Mark.
Good morning, Mindy.
Well, October is peak migration time. In last week's bird report, I believe you called it the peakest of the peak.
Yeah, I say a lot of things. but yeah, I think it is. it's kind of a birder's birding time of year because a lot of things are more subtle looking than, say, in the spring. But there's just so many birds out there. It's just they've had all summer to breed, so there's more of them, right? I mean, there's all those baby birds that they've been pumping out all summer long are out there with no place to go. Well, I guess they do have places to go. and so there's just more of them. And though they're in kind of subtle plumages, which makes it a little more challenging, there's just a lot of stuff out there. And the way things work on the Cape is, despite the fact that lots and lots of birds are moving, you know, late summer through September, we don't see them quite as much. They tend to just slip through or just straight over us and keep going. but when you get to this time of year, late September, October, we start to get some cold fronts, some more northwest winds, and migration just becomes a lot more evident. So October, it really is, I think. And I looked at the numbers. You know, I did this in the bird report, I think, last week. But I looked at the numbers in eBird in October, had something like 330 species of birds, you know, all-time reported here on the Cape. And May was like 334. So technically a little bit better. But really, I think the weather's really often really good this time of year. Today, not a good example of that. But it can be, and just the sheer abundance of things, and you know, they tend to be just more apparent, I think, more consistently apparent, all of the migrants that come through the Cape at this time of year.
And, you know, I guess you're a good time to put up the bird feeders, but if you don't put up bird feeders, just even the bird bath, just, and especially when we've had this drought, having the bird bath, it's amazing what you can see in your bird bath.
Right. And you see things that wouldn't come to feeders. And that's one of the things that I've been seeing in my yard in East Harwich here, where I'm the immediate vicinity of my neighborhood. There's no standing water. There's a wetland like two streets away. But and so these birds are thirsty around here. And so the activity at my bird bath over the last week especially has been incredible. And it's things like, you know, blackpoll warblers, yellow-rump warblers, and 2 days in a row, yesterday and the day before, a scarlet tanager. And like I was saying earlier, things tend to be more subtle looking in fall migration. And so scarlet tanagers are yellow right now. They look like big goldfinches to some people. so even a male scarlet tanager right now is kind of a dull yellow with black wings. but I looked out and there's a scarlet tanager in my bird bath, and I later found it in the neighborhood, kind of in, behind my neighbor's house, eating a wasp. I got some photos of it. I had a rare opportunity to do some bird photography. One child was sleeping and napping, and then I had my baby girl, and she fell asleep in the stroller, and I happened to have my camera, and there were birds all around. It was this magical confluence of events where I actually got to watch birds, you know,
yeah.
Really, like, take pictures, you know, watch their behaviors, and found this scarlet tanager just pounding away on a big black wasp. and then I saw it again the next day at my bird bath. But yeah, the bird bath has just been amazing. And I actually added a new one outside my, quote, office window, which is, you know, the side window of my bedroom where I've been working. And so I just put, I took the heated bird bath that I haven't put out yet and just put it on the ground there because there's been so much action. And
yeah,
because it's so dry. And so, yeah, warblers and tanagers, things that would not come to your bird feeder, will come to a bird bath. So if you do nothing else to attract birds, put out a bird bath.
Bird bath, yeah. I know. So this is a good time then to put, if for those who do want to put feeders out, this is a good time to do it?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I mean, I've had mine out for a while. I don't tend to do it in the summer. You know, it's just they don't really need it, and there's not that much around in the summer anyway, but this time of year when there's so many things coming through, you've got cold fronts, birds are stocking up and fattening up and caching food, so you're just going to get a lot more activity at your feeders now. I have a really simple, you know, I just have a couple of squirrel-proof feeders with black oil sunflower seed, and I do suet, and a couple of bird baths, and that's about it. But
now,
this year,
you don't have trouble with rats, Mark, with the feeders?
Periodically, but you just take them down for a while. You know, and I'm surprised I don't have more trouble with rats. I've got a neighbor a few houses down with chickens. I do backyard compost, and I know other neighbors do backyard compost. Those are like the big two, and combined with bird feeding, we should be overrun with rats based on those things as risk factors. But I've gone through periods where I see one, and I know they get into my compost because they tunnel up under it. I have a plastic one. But it's not persistent. If I take the bird feeders down, they tend to go away. I bought a big rat trap just in case, but I haven't really had to use it.
Hmm. Oh. So does it matter what type of seed you're putting out right now? I guess sunflower seeds, pretty much a lot of birds like the sunflower seeds, right?
Yeah, like we always say, that's the best overall. And you can buy, if you get the budget for it, you can buy the hulled stuff that leaves no mess. You know, you don't end up with all the sunflower hulls under the feeders, although I think they're pretty good compost. You know, and I usually buy a bag of the cheap stuff, you know, the basic mix that's mostly millet. You know, you see people with a feeder with that in it hanging outside a window, and it's nothing but house sparrows kind of cycling through. But I buy that, and I scatter some on the ground for sparrows who like millet, and they like to feed on the ground. But that, you know, you don't want to do that if you have rats, and in my case, it definitely encourages the chipmunks.
Oh, yeah.
I finally baffled the chipmunks. I went online and I just looked up do-it-yourself baffles for chipmunks. And one of the first things that came up was just like a plastic pot from plants you buy at the nursery, like a gallon pot. And I was like, geez, why didn't I think of that? I got a basement full of these things. And so I cut it up the side. I put it around the shepherd's hook pole that my feeders are on, which is how the chipmunks get up there. And the problem is the chipmunks are light enough that the squirrel-proof mechanism doesn't work on them. So the spring doesn't trip it. It doesn't close over the feeding ports like it would for a squirrel. So they just eat me out of house and home. And so I just kind of used some duct tape. I mean, this was an inelegant solution, but it works. I haven't had a chipmunk on my squirrel-proof feeder ever since.
But they try. I'm sure they try.
No, they don't.
It's like they're up. He's outsmarted us.
I don't see them like trying to get around it. I think they just eat what's on the ground now. Whatever drops.
866-999-4626 is our number for your bird comments, questions, or stories. 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. And Hillary's already sent us a note. She says, I was wondering, what is the best time of year to put up an owl nesting box? Also, where would be the best spot in a yard to put it to be safe and successful for the owls?
Yeah, it's a good question. I think no matter when you put it up, you'll probably have trouble with squirrels. That's all I've ever had in mine. And they were very, very busy in my owl box in, I don't know, September, I think, a few weeks ago, that there was never not a squirrel poking its face out, like making a nest, a dray, as they call them, you know. If you saw it in the tree with those big leaf nests, those big balls of leaves that they make, it's called a dray, D-R-E-Y, good Scrabble word. So, you know, if you wait a little bit later after they have gone through that nest-making period, maybe the squirrels will leave it alone. But basically, you're probably going to have to put it somewhere where it's relatively easy to access with a ladder, so you can clear out squirrel nests if you really want owls to occupy it. It may take a couple of years. Some people have beginner's luck and get them right away. Some people it takes years. You never know. But we have tons and tons of screech owls around here. Any wooded neighborhood, you know, especially if it's mostly deciduous trees, they'll be screech owls. They're super common. If you live near a red maple swamp, then you have tons of them. And so, you know, you've got a good chance if you put one up around here.
And about best time of year, can you put it up any time, or does it matter?
Well, I thought I answered that. I was saying, you know, if you wait a little bit later than now, after the squirrels go through this kind of early fall nesting period, then maybe that'll be better. But really, I feel like just put it up any time of year you
think
of it.
Yeah.
I know when it comes to projects, like, do it when you have
do
the
time. Do it when you can, yeah. Exactly.
Otherwise, I took me like 2 years, I think, to put one up at my house. I just kept thinking about it and not doing it.
Right.
But just be resigned to the fact that you will probably have a battle with squirrels.
And then what about, does it have to face a certain direction, or does it have to be like facing south or anything like that? Doesn't matter.
No, they've looked at that. So a good resource for this kind of stuff is Cornell's Nest Watch project. And I would encourage people, if you do have nesting birds in your yard, particularly in boxes, to sign up with Cornell Nest Watch and submit your data. But they have really good information about all kinds of, especially species that use nest boxes, including the best dimensions for the boxes, best height, distance from nearest tree, all that kind of stuff is on the Cornell Nest Watch page for screech owls and everything else.
Is it just the screech owls that you would get in a nesting box?
Well, it's basically the same dimensions as a wood duck box. If you were really lucky and you lived on a wooded pond, maybe, and people do. I know people who have backyard nesting wood ducks here on the Cape, would be really cool.
But no other owl species, just the screech owls?
No other owls. Oh, no, you know, if it was very piney, especially near a swamp, then you have a chance of northern saw-whet owls here on the Cape.
Right.
They used to say that this was the southernmost place that saw-whet owls nest along the coast here on the Cape. And they definitely nest here. There's a well-known place, you know, the Marconi Cedar Swamp in Wellfleet, but lots of other places, especially on the outer Cape, where they do nest. And they will use nest boxes. So if you're lucky, you might get one of those adorable little guys.
They really are, too. That's so cute.
Yeah.
You're listening to The Point. It's Bird News with Mark Faraday, Science Coordinator at Mass Audubon's Wellfleet Bay Wildlife Sanctuary. 866-999-4626 is our number for your bird comments, questions, or stories. We like stories. 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. All right, so Mark, tell us about this big invasion of pine siskins.
Yes. So every year, birders, backyard feeder watchers, we're all wondering, what will this winter be like? It's kind of a fun thing where it's really hard to predict what we will see in any given winter, because there's this suite of birds across the boreal forests, mainly, that do not have regular annual migrations like we think of a normal migration, where birds fly south for the winter and they go to Colombia or they go to Costa Rica and then they go back. These are birds that just sort of wander around. They're just cool birds. They do what they want, right? They're not beholden to your image of what a migration is. And so they wander the kind of northern tier of the continent looking for seeds. And so if the willow catkins are not producing seeds, then we'll see common redpolls. They'll come south in search of food. If the spruce cone crops fail in a big region of the Canadian boreal forest, then we might see red crossbills or white-winged crossbills or pine siskins. And so we got a hint during the summer when red-breasted nuthatches, which they're not a finch, they're a nuthatch, but they're part of this group of birds, that they're considered like an honorary winter finch. And so they started erupting. The word is erupt with an I. They started erupting southwards in big numbers. And so this was a hint that, ooh, maybe, you know, maybe it's going to be a good winter finch year. And certainly that has continued, and they're just everywhere. And I assume our listeners, if anybody with bird feeders has noticed this, that they're just around. And we have them year-round on the Cape. They breed here. But it's pretty clear that there's way more than usual. And then purple finches started. And this was just sort of, this was a little more subtle. You know, you might see two or three, but someone like me, like I can hear them flying overhead. They have a distinctive little sharp little call note that they give, but nothing big. But then, and then the siskins started, one or two here and there. I would hear them flying over my house. But over the last week, it's just been a deluge. Just all of a sudden, the siskins are coming. And Skylar Cardell is still over there on Puckernuck, and he estimated 1,000 one day.
Wow.
And that's probably a county high count ever. The Barnstable County high count was like 400-something. I had one day at the sanctuary about 6 years ago. So big numbers right now. I don't know that they're unprecedented, but people should be watching at their feeders for pine siskins. And it's a subtle bird, right? This is not a scarlet macaw. they're not going to hit you over. You're not going to look out your window and be like, "My God, what is that?" You know. And there have been some posts on the Nantucket Birding Facebook group where people are like, "What are these things in my yard?" And they post a video and they have like 50 pine siskins just mobbing their yard, you know, and they weren't there 10 minutes ago. It's, you know, cause they will show up very suddenly. They could overwhelm your feeders, and then they could be gone by the end of the day. That's kind of what's happening right now. But they're little. They're like the size of a goldfinch, but very streaky and brown.
Yeah.
And they're closely related to a goldfinch. And like a goldfinch, they are almost entirely seed eaters, which is actually... Despite the fact that we think of birds as eating bird seed, eating just seed is pretty rare among birds. But these guys are like exclusively seed eaters. And so they're going to be on things like weedy seed heads, either in your garden or in community gardens or along through the dunes, anything, especially things in the composite family like daisies and asters and goldenrods that have gone past, sunflowers. A lot of these daisy family things produce really good food for birds like pine siskins and goldfinches. And
keep our eyes open for these guys. Yeah.
Yeah. And so I haven't had them at my feeders. It was very insulting when I walked out and the first two that I actually saw, I've been hearing them fly overhead, but the first two I actually saw in the vicinity of my yard were ones that were, for some reason, on my neighbor's empty bird feeder. Meanwhile, mine are well-stocked just on the other side of the trees. And they're just like these two siskins on my absentee neighbor's empty feeders. Like,
oh, that's funny.
But then
the food's over here, yeah.
Yeah. And then a few minutes later, I saw 12 of them just kind of dropped out of the sky in their noisy way. They have some great sounds, kind of like buzzy calls that they make. Just dropped out of the sky, and they descended upon these kind of weedy, the plant called wild lettuce that you'll see just in like power line cuts and things like that, and that's what this was. And they were just covering the seed heads, just devouring them. So look for them wherever there's weedy seeds, you know. And this is, for me, this is a talking point that I'm always making about gardening for wildlife.
Mm-hmm.
And so leaving your seed heads, being a messy gardener in the fall, and leaving some of the seed heads for the birds, this is why. I mean,
it's a good thing for the birds. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, you never know when 50 hungry pine siskins are going to show.
They're
going to
drop down for lunch. All right, let's talk to Molly, who's giving us a call from Falmouth. Hi, Molly.
Yeah, hi there. Hey, Mark. Good thing about a messy gardener. But in addition to that, a friend said that if you get your feeders out early, you kind of establish a location for your winter residence. And I'm wondering if that's a motivation to get the feeders out now, the white throats and the birds that are coming from the north. We'll know it's a good restaurant stop, and we'll kind of establish a winter territory in your yard if you get a jump on it.
Oh, I hear you. I think the same way. I don't know that it's true. And I know it doesn't matter so much with chickadees and whatever, like your local chickadees, you know, if you don't put your feeder out until February, they'll find it 10 minutes after you put it out. But you're right, you know, things, some things are coming through now, and I feel like, you know, that's why I bought the millet, you know, to put out in case I get some white-throated sparrows that want to stay for the winter. But it's a logical thing that you want to get them while they're passing through. And so that's another reason this is a good time to get your feeders out. And for siskins, I think they'll eat anything, but they like what we used to call thistle seed, which is not at all thistle seed. It's like an African plant in the daisy family that Niger seed comes from. They patented this N-Y-J-E-R. They patented this phonetic way of saying this seed, but it's those little seeds that we used to call thistle seed. So if you get one of those feeders, you might end up with some regular siskins if they stick around.
Mm-hmm. Right, Molly, thanks for the call. Marilyn is calling from Chatham. Hi, Marilyn.
Hi. I have a few things. First of all, we have a screech owl box that we put up last fall, and we didn't have any activity in or on it until about 2 weeks ago, and now we've got a little screech owl in there.
Oh, yay.
Yeah, he's been poking his head out periodically and or being mobbed by the neighborhood birds. But, he's very sweet. He's just looking out occasionally, but other times he's just inside his little box. So I had a meeting this morning, so I missed the beginning. I heard you talking about screech owls, but I didn't know if that is this a like a winter roost, or could this be considered possible nesting?
Yeah, I mean, it could be either. So, you know, the birds that nest in cavities, if it's a local bird, they're always on the lookout for a place to nest, whether it's a chickadee or a woodpecker or a nuthatch. If you watch them just moving around through the trees, they're always poking their heads in the cavities. I watched a flicker doing that yesterday. It was doing that thing where they kind of like stick their head in a little bit into, this was my owl box, which is kind of flicker sized. And the flicker kind of sticks his head in a little bit. Anyone in there? Anyone going to eat me? You know, they're always checking out cavities. And I would guess the same is true for screech owls, though this time of year, it would be a winter roost.
Yeah. Okay, thank you. The other thing was about 3 weeks ago, it was after that we had all that wind during the day from Teddy offshore, and I was sitting in the living room reading, and I heard something on the screen, and I just assumed it was a bug, and after about 5 minutes, I went to close the window, and it was actually a little bird hopping around on the screen, and it was 10:30 at night, and I assumed it was something that was eating, found little bugs in the screen, but when I've heard them flying over at night, you know, I can hear their little cheeps and stuff, but I've never seen one actually actively eating or anything at 10:30 at night. So I couldn't tell what kind. It was just some striped, very small and with a striped belly breast.
Oh, wow. I bet it was a black warbler. It was very small with a striped, you said?
Yeah, stripes on its side and pale belly. Yeah.
So there are two common warblers right now. One of them is the black pole warbler, one of my favorite species to talk about, and they've been around. I mean, the other day, you know, everywhere I looked, there was a black pole warbler, and then the day before that, they were just in my bird bath, one after the other. And they're very subtle looking this time of year. They're just sort of like greenish, dull greenish yellowish, with some streaking on the sides, and they're getting rounder and rounder. They go into what's called hyperphagy, where they're just eating, eating, eating. They have to gain prodigious amounts of weight because from here they'll fly nonstop potentially to northern South America. And so they really need to put on some fat reserves. And so that's another reason why I'm thinking that's what it was, because they are very strongly motivated to eat constantly and put on weight. And maybe the light kind of got them out of their circadian rhythm, and they saw the moths and things on the side of your house and couldn't resist. I haven't seen that personally myself, but it's not that surprising.
Marilyn, thanks for the call. 866-999-4626 is our number. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. And John from Hyannis Whale Watch is on the phone. Hi, John. John, are you there? We'll come back to John. Maybe we're having a little trouble there. We have an email from Jill who says, I bought a squirrel-proof feeder last year on Nantucket. It has springs on the perches. Supposedly, the squirrel is too heavy to fall off. However, they quickly figured out how to sit on the top of the oval feeder and hang their body upside down and keep feeding until the feeder is empty at times. So much for squirrel-proof. Ha-ha. Love listening to the bird talk and many other great programs. Jill, thanks for the call. Those squirrels are smart. You know, if there is a place that can hang upside down.
Yeah. I've not had that experience. I've had these. Oh, red tail hawk. What was that? Something just went over my house. Probably one of the red tails that's been around. I looked out the window the other morning, and this, I don't have a very big yard, and this red tail was just sitting under the bird feeder. And it's a big bird. I mean, I've seen Cooper's hawks do that. They're like crow size, but a red tail is a startlingly big bird to see just sitting under your bird feeder and look out in the morning. But regarding the squirrel-proof feeders, I have not. I guess it'll happen. They'll breach the defenses. But I've seen them try to do that in places. But these particular ones that I have, they're not cheap. I don't know. They're like $60 or something like that. But they last a long time. You know, they're not cheaply made. And they, in my experience, they've been like pretty much 100% squirrel-proof. And I think if you just – I think there's a simple solution to that where you just add a baffle above it. So they can't hang from the top. Overall, I've had really good luck with the spring-loaded cage around where that drops over the feeding ports when the squirrels get on it. They pretty much have no trouble with squirrels anymore.
All right, let's talk to John, who's calling from Orleans. Hi, John.
Hi. Question. Are Cooper's hawks rare, or is there anything unusual about this? Because I got to see one on the ground, and it had a rabbit, and it just hopped away from me. I got to study it maybe 10 feet up to 10 feet away from it several times. So are they rare or unusual or what? It could not fly with it. Not much.
Yeah. No, they're not rare or unusual, but what's rare or unusual about what you describe would be that it had a rabbit. I mean, they're kind of a smaller, I mean, a red tail would be more likely. That typically what people see on a rabbit in their yard is a red-tailed hawk. They're a big, heavy hawk, and that's they have the size to deal with something the size of a rabbit. Cooper's hawks are like a skinny crow with a long tail. That's kind of their size, and they eat 99% birds. They hunt birds on the wing, you know, smaller birds, up to chicken size. They certainly, you know, they're the ones that used to be named chicken hawks. Cooper's hawks would get into coops and take people's chickens. But really, they're bird hunters. So I would love to see pictures. Hawks are very difficult to identify, even when they're sitting right in front of you. It's one of the most common ID questions you see, you know, online, and we get at Audubon. A sitting hawk can be very difficult to identify, but Cooper's hawks themselves have been getting more and more common over the last 40 years or more. They've made their peace with suburbia. They do very well with suburbia. They don't require like vast unbroken stands of forest to nest. Their populations have gone up and up since, I don't know, the 60s and 70s. Whereas sharp-shinned hawks, they're smaller, kind of doppelgangers. They're very similar looking. Sharp-shinned hawks are smaller. Sharp-shinned are still rare as breeders in Massachusetts. They prefer to have kind of bigger stands of mostly coniferous forest for nesting. But Cooper's hawks are just like suburban hawks now, and they're everywhere, and they're around summer and winter.
Yeah. John, thanks for the call. And, you know, the Cooper's hawk, when you watch them fly, it's amazing how graceful they are flying in between things that you would think, you know, would be difficult, but they're so graceful.
Oh, it's unbelievable. And that whole group of hawks, the smallest is the sharp-shinned, the Cooper's hawks are the medium ones, and then the biggest ones are the northern goshawks. And there's goshawks in Europe, and they put cameras on them. Mm-hmm. And so I think it was the BBC, and you can probably Google this up, but they take you on this wild ride. It's like a falconer's bird, and they put a camera on top of it, and they just take you through the forest. And they're just doing these impossible maneuvers where they, like, they go kind of vertical at the last second to fit between these two very close together saplings as they're pursuing forest birds. They're really, really impressive birds.
Yeah, for sure. Let's talk to Dave, who's giving us a call from Wellfleet. Hi, Dave.
Hello. I put up an owl box, not thinking anything would happen. And lo and behold, one day, a little face is sticking out of its hole. And every day, just before dusk, an hour before dusk, it would sit up in its hole and just sit and sit. And then right at dusk, it was like just dark enough where you couldn't see it. It would depart its box silently. Just couldn't even see it because the light wasn't strong enough to see it. And off it would go to, I guess, get dinner. One day, I went and after it took off for dinner, I scrambled up the tree, took down the box, installed a camera looking down from the ceiling of the box into the box, and put it back up. And I had a line that went into the house so that I could hook it up and, you know, watch what was going on to a monitor. And it would just, so it came back and didn't, you know, was unaware of this thing and just sat there, would sit there all day long just in this empty box. And occasionally I would see a little rodent on the bottom of the box. So it would go out, get it, bring it into the box, and just kind of sit there. And I guess when it got hungry, it would eat it. And that is my owl box story.
Wow.
Good for you.
That's fun and funny.
Yeah.
What kind of camera was it?
It was, so this was a while ago, years ago.
Oh.
And I can't even remember, but it was just something that you hook up to, you know, it was not wireless, so I actually had to have a wire that ran, you know, from the camera into the house.
Right.
So I can't remember. And it was a black and white. I think it wouldn't have mattered because there wasn't enough particular light to shed a lot of color on anything.
I was just going to say that, yeah, this is something that people can do at home, and it's even easier now than when you did it. I mean, Cornell has sort of cornered the market on Nest Cams, but people can have their own. And I know some people have their own kind of elaborate ones that they probably had a professional company put up on, like Osprey Nests and things. But with all the different nanny cams and doorbell cams and nursery cams and all that kind of stuff on the market, I think people can figure something out and peer into the lives of their nest box dwellers.
Yeah.
Right.
Dave,
you know, quickly, yeah. I was having a conversation with someone yesterday wondering whether animals get bored. And if ever there were time for boredom, it would be when that thing was just sitting in the box all day long. What do you think about boredom in animals?
Well,
good question. I don't know.
You would think that's when it would be sleeping because they're active all night. What could you tell? I mean, was it sleeping or was it just sitting there staring off into the darkness?
Well, it wasn't even because the boxes was a size. When it was in the box, it couldn't see out the opening.
Right.
And when it wanted to see out the opening, it would kind of have to climb up a little bit. In order to get its whole body kind of sitting in the opening. But otherwise, it was just staring at the wall the whole day. And you're right, maybe it was sleeping.
Yeah. Dave, but thanks for sharing your story. Yeah, thanks for sharing the story. I appreciate that. You're listening to The Point. It's Bird News with Mark Faraday, Science Coordinator at Mass Audubon's Wellfleet Bay Wildlife Sanctuary. 866-999-4626 is our number. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address, thepoint@capeandislands.org. And Phyllis is calling from Wellfleet. Hi, Phyllis.
There. I have two very different kinds of questions. I have a bird feeder that keeps getting practically emptied every single day as the birds are just sort of, I guess, bulking up for the winter. I have been here pretty constantly since March, so I have a whole bunch of regulars, I assume. But I'm going to be going back and forth over the next couple of months, and I'm wondering if I should take the feeder in when I'm gone, and then should I just leave it in for the winter, or should I put it out each time I'm here? That's the first question. And the second one is, right opposite the feeder is a very large plate glass window, and about 6 feet away. And I would say, in fact, it just happened again, I have little birds. Yesterday, there must have been 5 or 6 of them, at least, that just sort of fly into the window. Mm-hmm. And I'm so worried about what that they're going to get hurt, and I don't know what to do about it. So
okay. All right, Mark, let's take the feeder question first.
Yeah, good. Your second part changed my answer to the first part. I would say, you know, feeding birds is mostly for us, more so than for them. So you put out your feeders when you're there and able to enjoy them. But it sounds like you need to move that feeder or somehow reevaluate that situation so birds aren't hitting the window. There are various things you can do to keep them from hitting the windows, because, you know, little birds, especially if they get up ahead of steam, they will die hitting a window. It's a really, really common way for migrating birds to die, you know, not just on tall buildings, but on all of our millions of houses dispersed across the landscape. And if there's something about the placement of the feeder, I think you could either have the feeder like really close to the window or move it much further back and see if that changes things. I've tried ultraviolet laundry marking pens on the windows at the sanctuary, and those will work temporarily, but I think you have to keep reapplying them. It's basically invisible to us, but they can see it because they can see in the ultraviolet spectrum. There's all kinds of products online. The American Bird Conservancy promotes some products, but most of the things that really work are things that are visible to us on the windows, and, you know, so make it a little bit less attractive. But if it stops the birds from hitting the window, and that's your goal, they're worth a try. But some of these things are just strips that are a couple of inches apart on the windows. The foolproof method to keep them from hitting your window is to tack up some bird netting so that they bounce off of that and don't actually hit the glass. But, you know, you're looking through the bird netting then. But yeah, that should be foolproof.
All right. Phyllis, good luck with that.
Thank you very much.
Thanks for the call. Shelley writes, there's a huge nest atop a light pole at the base of the Bourne Bridge, Bourne end, southbound side, big, long twigs. What type of bird, I wonder? Hawk? Osprey? Seems like a busier spot than a bird would want to be in.
Yeah, I'm not sure of that particular one, but, I mean, ospreys, as we know on the Cape, are nest on all kinds of light poles and cell towers and telephone poles and big power line utility poles, and in addition to all of the nest platforms that we put up for them. And no place seems to be too busy or industrial for an osprey to nest. So that, I mean, it's probably what it is.
Well, next time you're going over the Bourne Bridge, take a look.
Yeah, I mean, big nests out in the open on Cape Cod tend to be osprey nests.
Yeah. All right. Let's talk to Terry, who's calling from Chatham. Hi, Terry.
Hi. I have a bird identification problem for you. Okay. We had a just recently we had a bird fly into our window, similar kind of problem as the last caller. We've now measured the wingspan because the imprint is on the window. It was 15 inches from tip to tip. We had a friend who's a very accomplished birder who was here. He thinks it was a hawk. The bird had to be flying at full speed. It's fortunately that we've looked around. There was no evidence of the bird being hurt or killed. There was even a little bit of a feather, a very pale, pale black. It was black on the tip, but a pale gray feather. And we've been trying to identify just what it might have been. But it was even the outlines of the wings are on the window.
Yeah, it's probably a mourning dove. That's the most common. I mean, certainly hawks. Hawks do things like Cooper's hawks. They're in hot pursuit of a bird around your feeder, and they will definitely bounce off the windows. I've seen it happen, and they're tough enough. I mean, they're tough as nails, but you know, they just sort of shake it off and seemingly recover and fly away. Mourning dove, in my experience, is the most common thing to hit windows. Their wingspan is right in that range, and they tend to have leave a lot of feather dust on the windows. But you know, I would have to see the feather. It could be any number of other things too. Sure. The mourning dove feathers tend to be that kind of soft dove gray, and you know, a pile of feathers left behind by a hawk is a mourning dove. Like, I don't know, 80% of the time, I feel like it's just. Mourning doves are pretty good at dying various ways. They're not the smartest birds in the world, and they're very common. And they like to be around houses, and hawks like to eat them. And so it's a very common bird to find the remains of or to find imprints of on your window.
Yeah. All right. Terry, thanks. Thanks for the call. Yep. Thanks for the call. And then we have Rick calling from Yarmouthport. Hi, Rick.
Good morning. So I'm trying to find out if this what we thought was a red-breasted nuthatch is common. We were out sailing for the final sail of the year a week ago Sunday, and suddenly there was this rather small bird hanging upside down under the boom for probably 10 or 15 minutes, and we just didn't think we'd seen one before, and it's trying to find out if they're common or not.
Well, yeah, could you describe it? Was it sort of reddish underneath with a strong eye line? Tiny,
yes, a very strong
tail.
Line. Correct.
What's that? Yeah. Yes. So they're everywhere right now. We talked about it at the top of the show, but they are. They erupted southwards from northern coniferous forests, and then you know. So we've got maybe several times the normal number we would have here on the Cape right now. And they're very acrobatic. They'll hang upside down. The interesting thing about what you said is that it hung upside down. I mean, these guys are like the definition of kinetic. You know, they're just always moving and making little charming chuckling sounds. I mean, they're really great to have around. They're tiny, adorable little birds that are just making little sounds, and they're upside down, then they're right side up, and then they're flying. They're never not moving. So when you see birds like chickadees and nuthatches that are always on the move, still like that, something is wrong. And it's often that there's a hawk, you know, someone has sounded the alarm. I'm looking at a red-breasted nuthatch is cycling through my bird feeder right now. You're breaking up a little bit, but it was on a broom, you were saying?
On the boom, on the sailboat. No. It was on the, yeah. And you probably nailed it.
Was this out on the water?
And we were probably 2 miles south of Bass River, so we're, you know, fairly offshore.
Oh, yes. Yes, that was a red-breasted nuthatch. So they're coming from places like the Canadian Maritimes, which means they end up out over the Gulf of Maine, and they will end up on boats. And so I think they're continuing to erupt southwards. A tiny little tailless bird is kind of reddish underneath, and then that strong face pattern they have, where they have a white line above the eye, dark cap.
Yeah.
they're beautiful little birds. And
they really are. Yeah, they're great. Rick, thanks for the phone call. John from Hyannis Whale Watch has made his way back. Hi, John.
Hi, guys. Nice to talk to you again after a season of not talking to you.
Right.
I was busy on the boat on Tuesdays, and I missed hearing the show and all that, so I usually caught up at night, but couldn't throw in any reports because we were a skeleton crew this year.
I bet.
Yeah. Good.
Go ahead.
Yeah, John, did you want to give us a report or tell us what you've been seeing?
Sure. No, I had a good one to share. I think just as we were coming out the other day of Barnstable Harbor, it was a pretty rough day. We knew we were hoping to get on some whales up by Race Point, kind of protected from the wind. And as we came out of Barnstable Harbor, we were looking down as we were coming out past the buoy and saw a big shape in the water and said, oh, it's a ocean sunfish, and went to change our course and realized it was about an 8 to 10 foot great white making its way along. We were able to jump up and get a few of the passengers on for a quick look. So that's always exciting, and they're here. You know, 18 years on this boat, I've seen them 6 times, so they're here, but not common to see. But it got even more interesting as we got out and couldn't find any whales by Race Point, and it was too rough to go out beyond. So we already knew we were kind of into a skunked trip, and we'd be giving out some rain checks when all of a sudden we were scanning the horizon, and I picked up something coming in, and I was like, it's something that's not the right shape for being out on the water. And it was a long ways off, but it kept coming from the west, and kept watching as this defined into some kind of a raptor and you know, a bird of prey. And then I said, my goodness, no, it's just not fitting anything I'd expect to see over the water. And as it got a little closer, I could see it had a rounded off front and long wings. And it was a short-eared owl, and that's a first. And with Halloween coming up, this short-eared owl, I've never seen him travel over the water, was heading toward Hatches Harbor and out toward the race, and that was exciting. And about 10 minutes later, we picked up a South Polar skua. And so even though we didn't see whales, we had some good sightings.
Still had some excitement.
Some of them were lost on others, but. There we go, a little bit, but I thought I'd get at least one sighting in for you before
our season wraps up
in a couple of weeks.
Yeah, glad you called, John. Thanks for that update, and hopefully we'll get more reports from you next season. Appreciate that. Just
there
about a minute or so.
To you guys.
Yeah,
boy,
thanks,
if
John.
If I was on that boat and you showed me a short-eared owl flying over the water in a South Polar skua, I would not accept my money back. I would pay you extra. I mean, that's incredible. Short-eared owl is the one owl I can think of that does migrate over water, and they actually do epic migrations over the Pacific Ocean, and I think that's why it's the only owl that ever colonized Hawaii.
Wow, good to know.
Made it way out into the middle of the Pacific and colonized Hawaii.
Yeah. We just have about 30 seconds left. Just want to mention that keep the hummingbird feeders hanging, right? We've had a few, seen at some feeders, two in Woods Hole in the last week. Yeah.
Up until yesterday in Woods Hole, there's one and a few others, you know, up until a few days ago, I've had them into early October. But pretty soon they should be disappearing, and we need to keep an eye out for the rare ones, the ones that are more orangey, have some orangey color on them, like rufous hummingbirds coming in.
Keep your eyes on that. You know, never know what you might see. And one caller suggested putting some brush at the base of your feeder pole to protect the ground feeders from hawks. Good idea. Mark Faraday, science coordinator at Mass Audubon's Wellfleet Bay Wildlife Sanctuary. Thanks, Mark.
Thank you.
I'm Indy Todd. Thank you for listening.
The Point is produced by Amy Vince. The executive producer is Mindy Todd. Production assistance from Jenny Junker and Dan Tridle. Theme music by Benjamin Verdery and William Coulter.